from WXXI News. This is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour was made when governments and citizens around the world began the transition to LED lighting. The shift was made for several reasons, starting with the promise of big energy savings. And so a headline in Gizmodo last week sparked some heated discussion in the scientific community about this issue. Here's the headline, quote, "The switch to outdoor LED lighting has completely backfired." Gizmodo reported, quote, "To reduce energy consumption, many jurisdictions around the world are transitioning to outdoor LED lighting. But as new research shows, this solid-state solution hasn't yielded the expected energy savings, and potentially worse, it's resulted in more light pollution than ever before," end quote. Energy consumption is a big part of the LED equation. Another is health and pollution. Gizmodo writes, quote, "Nighttime illumination is considered a serious environmental pollutant, one that's disruptive to nocturnal animals, plants, and microorganisms. But it's also bad for human health, as it disrupts the biological circadian rhythm, leading to metabolic disorders," end quote. So we should maybe ditch LED lighting, right? Well, not so fast. Scientists in various quarters immediately responded, pointing out flaws in the reporting. And this hour, we want to take the time to work through not only the state of LED lighting, but what energy efficiency means at home and beyond. Let me go ahead and welcome our guests who are with us for the hour. And we're all here because of this guy, Eric Hittinger. He's an assistant professor of public policy at RIT, who has plenty to say on the Gizmodo piece. Eric, welcome back to the program.
Hey, how's it going?
Very good. Also here is Bill Labine. He is with Airtight Services, Inc. Bill, what is Airtight? Tell us about that briefly.
Airtight Services is a cellulose insulation contracting firm, and I'm the part of the company that does energy audits, modeling, super efficient housing, Energy Star program, that kind of thing.
Very good. Thanks for being here. Also here is Mike Vigiani. He's president and CEO of Go Green LED International. Mike, what's the brief description of what Go Green is?
We're an ESCO and also a manufacturing for 64 fixtures that we produce off in China. And we are also a lighting designer for local municipalities.
All right, very good. And Scott Oliver is here. He is Deputy for Energy Programs at Pathstone Corporation. And Scott, tell us a little bit about what Pathstone does.
Well, Pathstone is a nonprofit that helps people with their homes. We get people grants, and we also offer non-biased energy efficiency advice with a contract through NYSERDA.
And there's an event coming up here, Pathstone and Sun Common hosting an energy efficiency workshop on December 12th, is that right?
Yes, December 12th.
All right, so we'll talk a little bit coming up here about what you want people to learn. But first I want to just peel back and talk about why we're here, because if you read the Gizmodo piece and you see the headline, and a lot of people don't even have to read the piece, Eric, they just see the headline, "The switch to outdoor LED lighting has completely backfired." You had some issues with the piece.
Yeah, well, the piece was actually written by some folks that were doing satellite imagery analysis. They were looking down at the Earth over several years at night and noticing that the amount of lighting, outdoor lighting, that's being used has been increasing over time. And they found that it increased about 2.5% a year over this period. And they extrapolated from this and started talking about what's known as the rebound effect in the world of energy efficiency. And what they claimed was that, hey, LED lighting is potentially a huge problem because as you make lighting cheaper, people will use more of it. And the headline used the word backfire. So there's a couple issues that I have with this.
All right. So but just to make sure we understand, a supposed rebound effect would be, it'd be like this. If the mashed potatoes your mother makes for Thanksgiving, she finally tells you, I'm going to use low-fat mashed potatoes, and you say, great, I'm going to have 8 servings instead of 1, that the piece makes it seem like that's kind of what's happening with lighting, which is that, oh, we find out, well, there's energy savings, so let's use the heck out of this stuff, and we end up using even more.
That's right, and that's a known thing in the world of efficiency. So, for example, I'll use my house when I talk about this in class. I say, look, my house, I have all LED light bulbs now, and I know how much it costs to run the light bulbs, which is almost nothing nowadays because they're about 8 times more efficient, or 10 times more efficient in some cases, as a traditional incandescent light bulb. So sometimes if I leave the room and I figure I'm coming back soon, I'll just leave the light on. Do I use a little more lighting than I would before? Yeah, but I don't use 8 times as much. So rebound generally is a thing that eats into your energy savings. But a lot of studies have shown that it mostly doesn't eat up all or even most of your energy savings.
Which is what the headline is implying, right? I mean, the piece is stating pretty clearly here that the rebound has been so strong that we've lost any potential savings, and we're seeing more light pollution. They write that the world is getting lighter. I'll quote from the piece. They say, as the new results show, the amount of outdoor lighting around the world has increased during the past several years. And as a result, the world has experienced widespread loss of the night, with half of Europe and a quarter of North America experiencing substantially modified light-dark cycles. Again, that's according to the researchers in the new study, which was published in Scientific Advances.
Yes, that's right. So they're claiming that it's washed out the energy savings, so they don't present a lot of data to support that argument. And in fact, they use the term backfire, which has a specific meaning in rebound. That is where you use so much more of the service when someone gives you a more efficient version that you actually end up using even more energy than you started with. And that's not supported by the data that they have there. They show a growth in lighting.
Not in energy, in actual lighting.
In actual lighting, right?
But not a growth in the energy used from lighting.
Right. In fact, the original paper doesn't even estimate the energy use. They just sort of wave their hands in that general direction and talk about rebound and backfire. And the other piece that I like to point out is that this growth in lighting, they connect it to LED lighting. However, this has been a long-term trend. There's actually several papers that have looked back at the last several hundred years of lighting use and found that for the last 300 years, lighting use has grown at about 4% a year, about 3% a year over the last 50 years. So their finding in this paper was that it's grown 2.5% over the last 5 years, and they attribute that to LED lighting, but frankly, that's just a long-term trend. As we get wealthier and need more lighting service and have more population, we use more lighting overall over the entire Earth.
Did they find that the biggest gains or the biggest increases in lighting, again, not in lighting energy, I'm just talking about actual lighting, did they find that the biggest increases in lighting were in less developed countries?
Yeah, that's right. So they pointed out that in developed places, the United States, Europe, that the surface lighting hasn't been increasing at all, at least over this five-year period that they looked at. And the growth rate is in these developing countries, which leads me to one of my other objections. When people talk about rebound like this, they forget that normally when we take some useful product and we figure out a way to make it cheaper, like lighting, you make more efficiency, you provide lighting for lower cost, and then people use more of that thing, that's just rational economics and frankly usually considered a good thing if we can make some useful product cheaper. And so the fact that developing countries are using more lighting, that should be considered potentially a positive development, that more people can read at night, more people can be safe at night when they're driving or walking around in parking lots or cities.
Okay, and so frankly, that sounds to me like what they found was what should be obvious, that the biggest gains in lighting are in places that are developing. Okay, that's obvious. That here in the United States and in other more developed countries, there hasn't been an explosion in lighting, even though the headline makes it seem like that. And what about possible energy savings then? What can we at least infer from the study?
Well, frankly, from this study, it's sort of hard to infer much. Because it's looking at lighting from outer space, there's a lot of complicating factors, such as LED light bulbs, for example, should throw less light up into the sky because they're usually more directional. They can point the light down. And if we want to learn about energy and cost savings due to LED lighting in the U.S., we probably want to look at the on-the-ground studies, which basically have shown that cities and municipalities in general that switch to LED lighting do this because they save a decent amount of money. This is especially true for any kind of indoor lighting. If you replace fluorescent light bulbs, CFLs, or especially any kind of incandescent light bulbs with LEDs, you tend to save a huge amount of energy and money.
All right, so I want to ask you, what, Eric, what you made of the quotes that showed up in various parts of the piece, and I'll go ahead and read from them. You got a big smile on your face because you probably aren't a big fan, maybe, but we'll see. Here's what the study author told Gizmodo. Quote, I expected that wealthy countries would appear to be getting darker, even if that wasn't truly the case. Instead, we observed wealthy countries staying constant, or in many cases, increasing. That's according to Christopher Kaiba, lead author of the study and a researcher at the German Research Center for Geosciences, in an interview with Gizmodo. And he went on to say that means that even though some cities are saving energy by switching to LEDs, other places are getting brighter by installing new or brighter lamps that need new energy. So the data isn't consistent with the hypothesis that on the global scale, LEDs are saving energy for outdoor lighting applications, end quote. And let me read one other quote, and we'll let Eric respond. John Barentine is the resident physical scientist for the International Dark Sky Association. He told Gizmodo, quote, "This study is important because it validates with data two things we have suspected, that the rate of growth of light pollution continues upward on a worldwide scale, and that the migration of outdoor lighting from older technologies to LED isn't having the anticipated benefit in terms of global reductions in energy usage. The latter point is especially important because a number of governments have been convinced to convert their outdoor lighting to LED on the basis of promised reductions in energy uses." End quote. Okay.
Yeah. So let me start with the second one about the light pollution. So light pollution actually is a legitimate issue that we have probably arguably too much lighting in the United States, outdoor lighting, and there's a lot of ways.
Well, why do you say too much?
Well, we light empty roads, we light empty parking lots, and secondly, we also throw light upwards where it doesn't have any value, right? We can direct the light downwards, which A, makes our light fixtures more effective, but B, also reduces the light pollution, which is, as the article correctly mentioned, a problem for humans, a problem for wildlife, a problem for people that frankly just want to be able to see the stars at night. So light pollution is an issue. However, the article implies that the switch to LED lighting should be reducing overall consumption of lighting, in my opinion, completely counterintuitively. That if you provide me a new technology that makes a service cheaper, you should expect me to probably use more of that service, all else being equal. So I don't know why the authors would propose that the switch to LED lighting would reduce lighting consumption overall.
Unless it's their argument, as these quotes demonstrate, that they think LEDs are not actually saving energy. I'm not talking about light output. I'm talking about energy. And again, that's where you say, no, the study does not demonstrate that LEDs are not saving energy.
Yeah, that's right. The study, frankly, doesn't do any estimates of energy use at all. They just sort of hang that on the end of their study. Without casting too many aspersions, although I sort of can't avoid it at this point, I think it was a great study as far as looking at the change in light pollution going up into space, but these were physical scientists getting probably too deep into the economics and human behavior aspects of energy efficiency in ways that they weren't familiar with.
Okay, so overstepping their bounds a bit.
I would say so, yeah.
Okay, and let me also read you what this is where maybe we have some agreement. That same scientist, John Barentine, said, here's what we should do. He says, the solution is actually quite simple, but it will require us to gradually change our relationship with light at night. He said, quote, we could instantly reduce the problem by about half if we assured that all outdoor lighting fixtures were fully shielded, meaning that they admitted no light directly above the horizon. We could then further reduce the amount of light pollution in the world if fixtures were properly designed and installed, such that the light they admit was confined to the task area and provided in no greater intensity than needed to safely illuminate the task. And lastly, we could reduce the biological harm of our lights by ensuring that they admit as little short wavelength light as possible by choosing warmer lamps. You agree with any or all of that?
Yeah, that sounds great to me. Frankly, this study does a great job pointing out the growing issue of light pollution, and talks about many ways that we can reduce that and reduce it cost effectively, frankly. So in that sense, I think the study does a great job. Yeah.
Can I also, before I take our first phone call, and then we're going to kind of move the discussion in other directions here, can I also just say, and I'm curious to get your thoughts on this. You know, you responded pretty quickly when you saw the Gizmodo piece, and you certainly weren't the only person in public policy or science to respond pretty strongly here, because that kind of headline, it can be damaging, right? Don't you think?
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay, and so this is where I actually think a couple of things. Number one, I think it's healthy. I think science needs this, because science needs to be challenged and results need to be sort of explained. And that's kind of what Eric was doing. I saw him doing it on Twitter. And by the way, I saw a lot of people who you interact with in various places here and abroad jumping right in and agreeing with you or kind of elaborating on their issues with the Gizmodo piece. I find that healthy. Are you concerned, though, that that discussion and clarification doesn't get as much attention as the first headline and that it does damage?
Well, I mean, I'm here talking to you today, so that helps. But yes, I mean, I think science has always existed in a world of debate, right? That's always been an important piece of the scientific enterprise. But, you know, these days, sometimes getting eyeballs on articles ends up being very important. But frankly, the ones that are the most controversial tend to get response articles and criticism articles. It's very common these days to have, one outlet publish an article that is perhaps extreme in one direction or shows one point of view. And soon afterwards, another outlet will say, hey, actually, we have a response here from a bunch of famous scientists that say the opposite. And so I think the debate is continuing in a pretty healthy way, with the possible caveat that I wish that, you know, headlines didn't need to grab attention quite as much as they do.
I think scientists or the actual journalists who write the headlines should have write the articles should have to write the headlines. Headline writers often do a lot of damage by misinterpreting or overinflating in a lot of different realms. So my takeaway after listening to Professor Hittinger is this. When it comes to LED lighting, outdoor lighting, we should not be surprised that we might see more actual lighting. That's not energy usage, that's more lighting, because we're making it more efficient. In some cases, a lot more efficient. So sometimes people will use more of it. That doesn't mean that it overcomes or cancels out energy savings. We don't have the evidence of that at all, and many reasons to believe that there are still good energy savings, and that there's been a long-term trend toward more lighting, especially in less developed countries. That shouldn't surprise us either. All fair?
Yeah.
Okay. So that's a little less sexy than the Gizmodo headline. Let me grab a quick phone call before we go another direction. It's Patrick in Rochester. Go ahead, Patrick.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call, and appreciate the discussion. I think I might have missed the conversation about spectrum. I have LED lights in front of my house and LED lights all over my house, and I think the spectrum, like the color of the light, is better than like old street lights, and it's very similar to incandescent bulbs that we've been using for hundreds of years. They also come on right away, so like unlike a fluorescent bulb where it kind of blinks for a while. So I just love LED bulbs all over for all the aspects. I had a question about the environmental impacts of the bulbs themselves. I know that like a fluorescent bulb has some stuff that's kind of nasty, including mercury. I was just curious if LED bulbs have that same sort of dangerous an adverse environmental impact.
Well, I'll start with Eric, or anybody want to jump in here? Yeah.
Mike Vigiani with Go Green.
Yeah, go ahead, Mike.
The LED has no impact. It's all green, so it's kind of like you can recycle the plastic, the aluminum, on like a T8 or a T12 bulb, and it's all recyclable. You could really reuse the plastic and the metal for the bulbs.
Okay. Does that help, Patrick?
It does, yeah. So LEDs everywhere, all the time, for everybody.
That is correct.
Patrick, thank you. I mean, Eric, would you agree with that last statement from him?
Yeah, I agree. So certainly the CFLs have mercury. LEDs are generally considered, a cleaner and better solution across the board for just about every reason, yeah.
Okay. Listeners, if you got questions on this, we can talk lighting and a lot of different things when it comes to energy efficiency at home. 844-295-TALK. It's toll-free, 844-295-8255 or 263-WXXI if you're in Rochester, 263-9994. You just heard Eric Hittinger, who is an assistant professor of public policy at RIT, and Mike Vigiani, president and CEO of Go Green LED International. Bill Labine is here from Airtight Services and Scott Oliver from Pathstone Corporation. And so let's take this discussion. Our listeners can help drive it, but let's also talk about what's coming up here. And Scott, on December 12th, from 5:30 to 6:30 p.m., Pathstone and SunCommon are hosting an energy efficiency workshop. Why now, and who are you aiming at this at?
Well, we're looking at homeowners in the Rochester area to come by and learn what's available as far as products from NYSERDA. You know, there's a couple different programs out there to help, you know, people from a variety of incomes, everywhere from a free program to 50% off. There's low-income loans or low-interest loans. So we help people get in touch with those. And then Sun Common's going to be there to tell people about the various solar products that they offer. So you can come down, find out about how to get a free energy assessment for your home, and learn how you can make your home more efficient. And then once you do that, you can go for solar and make it really efficient.
Okay. And first of all, this event on December 12th,
yes,
from 5:30 to 6:30, where is it happening?
404 East Avenue, which is it's kind of off Prince Street. It's right downtown Prince and East.
Okay. And it's free to come out. And when it comes to home energy assessments, is there anything that is costly to the homeowner? In other words, can I simply get an assessment for free on just about anything when it comes to solar or trying different things to my home? And if it's free, why haven't I done that? You guys can't answer that because I should probably answer that question myself. But is there anything that costs money or for the most part, can you get free assessments?
Well, basically NYSERDA, which is the New York State Energy Research and Development Authority, offers basically a free assessment for all homeowners in the state of New York. You can basically get one per home. And a qualified contractor will come to your house and spend about 2 hours going over everything from the attic to the basement to see where you're using energy and how you can make changes to your house to make it more efficient. So that's there's no cost to you for the obviously for the assessment itself. Once you decide to get work done, then there's a variety of programs to help you pay for that work.
Sure. And I am not at all a shill here, even though I'm about to sound like it, but I still can't figure out why I or anybody else wouldn't have a free assessment, right?
Well, why don't people go get their checkups for the doctor?
That's a good one. That's a very good point.
You don't want to know what your blood pressure is sometimes, right?
Well, that's
how bad is my house?
Yeah. But I think that most of these energy assessments can really offer, everything from some really simple tips to, in-depth whole house renovations. So it depends on how deep you want to go.
All right. So, Bill, what would you say to homeowners who are thinking about, assessments and what they can learn about their property?
We recommend assessments as the first step. We offer assessments that go beyond the free ones. So we do charge for that. So you would have to fork over a little bit of money.
What's it cost?
About $250,
okay,
for a standard assessment with a report with recommendations.
Okay.
I think it's important to point out it's really tough to describe how efficient a house is, and the utility companies keep that data very, very secretive. It's something they're not looking to share with anybody, and we're not really sure why that is. But if you compare the average house in Rochester to the new passive house standard, houses in Rochester are about 5 to 10% efficient.
Hold on, back it up again. Yep. Define those terms for our listeners again.
Well, the passive house standard was arguably developed in Europe about 10 years ago. There have been tens of thousands of buildings, not just homes, that have been built to this standard. And there's many things to it, but basically you need to use less than 4 kilobtus per square foot per year. And that's a number that, people don't understand what that means.
Nope, I don't.
So I try to avoid that, but I do like to use that as the basis on which to compare other homes to let people know, how efficient is, you've got developers out there advertising that they're building these incredibly good homes because they're building to the new energy code. And from my perspective, that's the least efficient home you can legally build. And how does anybody know? What are you going to compare it with? Your 5% efficient home, and you really don't know how efficient your home is. So it's hard for people to judge that. But when you can show them that it is 5% or 10% or 15% as efficient as a passive house, that gives people an idea of how much there is to save. And I think it also begs the question, do I spend money, tens of thousands of dollars maybe, on a solar electric system and put that on my 5 or 10% efficient house? Or should I think about making the house itself, the shell, the windows, the air tightness of the whole assembly, do I make that more efficient? And then this little solar system would have a greater chance of powering the entire home and maybe having something left over for the electric car that you dream about getting someday. So we try and put it in understandable terms, but there's an incredible amount of potential for people to improve their homes. And we hope that discussions like this, talking about efficiency, is what we like to do. We think it's exciting. Not everybody thinks.
I do. That's why we're. That is exciting, why we're here. And by the way, we've got some very interesting questions coming in from listeners. And so we're going to get our only break of the hour now, and we're going to come back with our listeners. But first, let me ask our guests to tell us, because some of our listeners have asked, how to get in contact with you. So Bill Labine from Airtight Services, online where?
Bill.Labine@airtightservices.com.
They can email you. And you, are you guys a website online?
Yeah, if you look up, we've got Facebook presence. We've got a website.
Okay.
soliver@pathstone.org.
All right, that's Scott Oliver with Pathstone and Pathstone Online.
Yep, we have a website, and we're kind of in the middle of building a new one right now, so stay tuned.
Okay. Mike Vigiani from Go Green.
WDLBW, Go Green LED International, 917 East Main Street, Rochester, New York.
And this gives me an excuse to ask you, Eric Hittinger, who you should be following on Twitter, why is your Twitter handle what your Twitter handle is? What's your Twitter handle?
Yeah, so my Twitter handle is @elephanteating. One word there.
That does not seem energy efficient.
Yeah, it doesn't seem energy efficient. Yeah, so that actually was originally a thing I used to talk about bike trips. Biking across the country is like eating an elephant.
I see.
But these days, it really reminds me about the climate change problem, that, you know, dealing with climate change, the line is, dealing with climate change is like eating an elephant. You just do it one little bite at a time.
Oh, so there is a good story behind it. All right, so those are our guests in studio. We got questions coming via phone, via email, and we're going to hit all of those after our only break of the hour right here on Connections. Coming up in our second hour, Daniel Ponder is a criminal defense attorney by day and lead singer of Daniel Ponder and the Tomorrow People by night. She channels her frustrations with her day job into her work on stage. She sings about justice, and she's going to be performing on Friday at the Little Theater in a special event called For the Love of Justice. We'll talk about music, themes of justice in her work, and more with Danielle next hour. And welcome back to Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our first phone call from Keith. I don't know where you are, Keith. You're always traveling, but go ahead, sir.
All right. Well, right now I went from Pittsburgh to Victor, but that's what happens when you drive the speed limit. That's my story. Couple comments. Incandescent bulbs are 100% efficient in the wintertime. The one thing I don't like about CFLs, and I still have a few remaining, is that you can't put them, you can't dim them. They're either on or off. And the same goes for some of the LEDs. The cheaper ones are not dimmable. And I bought a foreclosure several years ago and just gutted everything except for the furnace and put in all high energy efficient appliances, from the little disposal, microwave, to everything else. Went with a gas stove. I live in the same neighborhood I live in. I maintain the house at the same temperature. But I do see a decrease in my energy usage on this house versus the other house, which was literally six houses down the street. The other thing I just changed over was I went to a Nest thermostat, which gives you the ability to, you know, tweak it on the fly if you want to, or it has a learning mode too. But if the dog walks in front of it, the thermostat thinks the dog is a person. So, but there's a lot of things you can do. But my furnace right now only runs at 85% efficiency on the heating side. but that was standard 15 years ago when the house was built. But it does have 2x6 exterior construction, so it's got more insulation than it was wrapped. But when your guest mentioned about how much energy houses waste, how is he determining that?
It's a good question, Keith. Thank you. And what I want to do is I want to work through several parts of Keith's phone call because he's got a couple of things here. First of all, let's talk about the waste and how are we determining houses and wasting energy. Was that Bill Levine?
Yeah. As far as wasting energy, again, I'm using a new standard, the Passive House Standard, as my basis for comparison. It's the most rigorous energy efficiency standard that I know of. There's actually now two versions, but from a layman's perspective, the house is going to be equally as efficient under the U.S. Passive House Standard or the international. So when I compare them, I'm comparing either the heat load, i.e. how big of a heating system you need for the house, or alternately, how many BTUs or kilowatt hours you need to heat the house through the year. And so, again, a passive house is about 10 times more efficient than an existing building, and or the flip side is that you can say the existing buildings are about 10% efficient compared to the passive house standard.
Okay, he also brought up a couple of other things. Nests. What do you guys think about nests? Are we for... Eric, did you say yes to that?
Yeah. I have a Nest at home myself. I actually, my favorite killer app of the Nest is the data gathering that you can go and see how many hours of heat you used each year, which I go and, because this is what I do professionally, gather it all and run all this analysis. So I can tell you, for example, how much heat I'm using each day, how much heat, I have a wood-burning stove, how much heat each log I burn displaces in terms of natural gas, things like that.
Okay, how do you guys feel about Nests?
Yeah, they're pretty good thermostats that, you know, I like them because they get people into thinking about how can you make your house more efficient, what's going on.
You're a little more engaged with it, and maybe a little bit more educational. Okay,
anything that gets people thinking about it is good. The interesting thing about a setback thermostat is that you're really admitting how inefficient your building is. If you're going to save a lot of energy by setting back the thermostat, that means you're wasting a whole lot of heat through the shell. So if you build a passive house, you really don't do setbacks because, I mean, you could set it back, but the house on a cold winter night would lose 1 or 2 degrees through the night. So it turns out with the heating systems we use, it's more efficient to just run the house at a constant temperature.
He also brought up dimmable LEDs. You guys want to jump on that? Go ahead.
Yeah, the higher-end quality LED is definitely more dimmable, and the cheaper ones, they're step-dimming, so you can't really dim them all the way down because they're blinking.
Okay. And Professor Hittinger, go ahead.
Yeah, I was going to add, the very first point you made was about incandescent light bulbs being 100% efficient in the wintertime, right? Which is true, right? An incandescent light bulb is basically a space heater.
For indoor lighting.
For indoor lighting. It's basically a space heater that happens to throw off a little bit of light.
Because they're about 3 to 5% efficient?
Yeah, something like that.
For making light.
So in the winter, hey, we're making heat anyway, the argument would go, and all that waste heat isn't actually a waste in the winter. However, if you do the math, right, it's a lot cheaper to heat your house with natural gas than with electricity.
Or with a heat pump.
Or with a heat pump. Right? I'm sorry. But it's certainly not the most efficient, cost-effective way to heat your house. So if you run the math, I want to assure the listeners, even given the heating benefits of an incandescent light bulb, it still saves you an awful lot of money to switch to LEDs.
If you're on that, I mean, an LED is also 100% efficient inside a house because when we talk about the efficiency of a light bulb, we're usually talking about how much light it's giving off. But all the energy that isn't light is heat. So if you're heating most of the year, then that would work. Not so much in the summer.
All right, let me get Alex in Brighton next. Go ahead, Alex.
Hello. Great great discussion. I had a couple more things that I wanted to mention. One of them was related to the benefits of the LED lighting, which unfortunately you guys passed a long time ago. But one of the things that I thought is worth mentioning that environmental impact is also significantly reduced because it lasts for 20 years. And, you know, after 20 years, it's supposed to degrade by 30% or so its lighting output. So you throw away much less light bulbs, which, you know, the CFLs last about three times the incandescent and LED is much longer. So the other thing that I wanted to mention is you guys talked about light pollution outside and the associated energy use as well. So one of the things that can be done, I believe, you know, there are a lot of technologies that can detect presence or motion or whatever that can be used to activate lighting. A lot of times we have roads that are lit all night or half the night or whatever, and there's nothing on the roads. And so, you know, if the motion detectors and variety of different technologies are inexpensive enough where they could be used to reduce the lighting for those hours, and that's a significant part of the night. So those are a couple things that I wanted to mention about the lighting.
Okay, Alex, thank you for the phone call. Some thoughts on that from our guests, Professor Hettinger?
Well, and I would even add to what Alex had said, that LEDs actually enable that sort of motion sensor response, because the traditional sodium lamps that most cities have used for decades, they take several minutes usually to turn on, so a motion sensor wouldn't work very well if the light itself took a few minutes to turn on. But LEDs can turn on instantaneously, and so that enables that sort of technology. You could imagine a car driving down an empty road and all of the street lights turning on just above the car and turning off after it goes by.
Okay.
Yeah, there's similar things for pedestrians walking up to an apartment building. There's a lot of lighting available today that would have a low lighting level, but then the motion detector says, this person's coming to the door, let's boost up the lighting, and it'll stay on for a few minutes, and then it'll go back down to the lower. So yeah, we're just scratching the surface. Fortunately, there are many, 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 many ways to reduce our energy usage for lighting.
Well, in our brief break, the subject of Christmas and holiday lights came up, and they're already all over the place. So when it comes to energy efficiency, what do we need to know? Bill, I'm going to start with you here. What would you tell people about Christmas and holiday lights, energy efficiency, when to use them, what kind, et cetera?
Well, again, there's a huge improvement with the use of LEDs over the other ones. But people are also, I think, getting the idea that, woohoo, it doesn't affect my electric bill anymore, so I can go out and buy these things and light up my entire life.
This is where the rebound effect comes in. Now, this is like a real world
rebound
effect.
This would be a rebound effect.
Maybe even a backfire effect eventually, depending on if you go Chevy Chase on it.
Right. And if the satellites are doing their imagery during December in North America, they're going to see an awful lot of Christmas lights.
Okay, so the war on Christmas hasn't really worked out for the war side, because we're still using a lot of lights here. Satellite images prove that the war on Christmas has been lost. Okay.
Something like that. But there's a lot of interesting things. You can light up the whole front of your house with moving snowflakes and things like that for just a few watts. So it's pretty amazing what you can do for very little energy.
Okay. All right. So that answers that. Now let's hit a couple of other listener questions that have come in. I'm going to grab Elisa's question first. She wanted to know on Twitter, she says, on the home energy assessment, if they send a contractor to your house, is the contractor going to try and sell you some service?
Well, yeah. I mean, that's they're a contractor, and when they're doing this,
thank you for the honesty.
Yeah, they're doing an assessment, and they've got to stay in business, and they're trying to sell it. But the thing that we do is, and all bets are all honesty, I used to be one of those contractors, and now I work for the state offering free advice. So if you get this report from your contractor, you can bring it to me for free, and I'm happy to go over with you and you know, suss it out and tell you what looks good and, you know, what you should, you know, listen to what your needs are too. So I mean, we're an advocate. So we help out in that situation.
And he also helps if you get a contractor that does furnaces and all they want to sell you is a furnace, and you get a window contractor and all they want to sell you is windows, Scott will weed those contractors out of the list that he sends to people's houses. So,
or if you're not happy with the contractor, I can usually find you another contractor that's happy to do an assessment that looks at your needs. So.
I think maybe what Elisa is also asking is, can I trust that the assessment is going to be presented to me in an accurate way, as opposed to just I'm going to kind of slant this data to sell you a product?
The assessments are not perfect by any means. They're okay. I would say they're pretty good. But you know, I think that what happens is that the people doing the assessments are do it every day, and they get into that mindset, and they forget how to explain things in clear language to the people who want to get that information. So that's what my job is. You know, I try to explain the tech ease of people, you know, so that they can really understand what's going on.
Okay. Steven on Twitter says, I just signed up for my NYSERDA energy assessment. I received an email for my grant. What comes next? Do I have to hire my own contractor? Does NYSERDA recommend folks in Rochester?
Well, we have a list at Pathstone of all the contractors in the area. You probably, we have a list of the contractors that are available. We can email it to you and give you some advice as to, you know, what you're looking for and who might be able to help you.
So, but what would you tell Stephen about, so he does have to hire his own contractor then?
Well, yeah, the contractor who does the energy assessment. Yeah, it's a free energy assessment, but you have to pick the contractor.
Okay. Stephen, hope that helps there. Christopher, go ahead.
Might add one thing. Just because that contractor does the assessment doesn't mean you have to do the work with that contractor. You can go and, you just have to use a contractor. To get NYSERDA grants and financing, you have to use a contractor that participates in the program.
Okay. Christopher in Rochester says, we've known for a long time that looking into an LED light can be damaging to your eyes, but is that still true? And is looking into a regular clear household light damaging in the same way? I like that the term regular light still means not LED, which is an interesting, just show you how the shift is still kind of happening. But when it comes to looking directly at them, concerns?
I don't know about damages, but I do suggest frosted lenses on all LED. So any light bulb that we suggest for gyms, schools, it's all frosted. So it looks like traditional lighting that normally you see.
Okay.
So you can't actually see the LED chip.
Okay. Bill?
Yeah, it's not advised to look directly at light bulbs.
Yeah. I looked at the trap,
not as
right?
bad as the sun, but yeah.
All right. Hope that helps you there, Christopher. And let me get Norman sends an email with a thought on what we can do to help. He says, we could cut down a great deal on needless energy consumption and of light pollution by using reflective lane markers on our highways rather than by using overhead lighting. It's on-demand lighting and is more effective than overhead lighting on rainy nights when the wet pavement and painted lane markers are indistinguishable from each other. You guys think about that. Is that a feasible idea?
I think it's a great idea if you could have some type of lane markers that could light up. That's not illuminated. It's a paint surface. I think it's a great idea. I don't think we're there yet, but it sounds like a great idea.
Okay. Edward writes to the program and says, can I use an LED bulb in the glass-enclosed light fixture on my front lawn? Presently, I'm using up my old fluorescent bulbs in that fixture.
As long as it's watertight.
Simple as that. Yeah. Okay.
Yep.
And if it's watertight, should he be using the LED then?
Yes.
Okay. So there you go, Edward, if you can make it watertight. I'm going to read Kara's email, and I'm going to direct this to Professor Hittinger because he's the one to blame for having this program today. So I'll make you answer this one. Kara writes to the program and says, Evan, I just read about a huge new house up near Lake Ontario, I think more than 20,000 square feet. Eventually, at some point, public policy has to address house size and maybe even set some legal limits. That's from Kara. So, all right, Professor Hittinger, it's a little far afield, but Do you think eventually we're going to be looking at just the size of our living footprints? And do you think 100 or 1,000 years from now, if we are still here and we haven't returned to, you know, just dinosaurs again or whatever, that that there will either be regulations or at least some sort of societal norms about this?
Yeah, so questions like this actually are a hot topic in the sort of long-term energy planning world. There are people that argue that what we need to do, we use too much energy, it's causing all sorts of environmental issues, and what we need to do is scale back on our consumption. We use less, pollute less, have smaller footprints and whatnot. However, there's also another group, which I would term the eco-modernists, that say the opposite is true. They basically are technologists and say, no, like, technology will save us, essentially. What we need to do is continue, you know, enjoying our lifestyles, but figuring out ways to make our lifestyles more compatible and lower footprint, right, and use technologies so we don't have environmental effects from what we consume and what we do. I'm actually not sure which one of those is probably right. I think, you know, I'll tell you, between us,
No one's listening.
Hopefully someone's listening, but between us,
I'm listening.
I'm more of a technologist, so I think technology has the capability to save us. However, I think, you know, technology won't save us unless we have proper policy and strong intentions and investment in that direction. So to me, I don't know that I would advocate for limiting house sizes exactly, but I'm a strong proponent of limiting, for example, the emissions impacts of our electricity use, of our energy production, mm-hmm. and our entire way of gathering and transmitting energy.
But maybe the part and parcel with Kara's email is the idea that if we're going to put legal limits on output, energy output, that eventually a certain size house would probably exceed that to begin with, no?
Well, maybe. I mean, if you're wealthy enough, I guess my argument would be that hopefully the hope of the eco-modernists is that technology continues to progress to the point where we can all enjoy lavish lifestyles, that the standard of living can continue to improve in both the developed world and the developing world, and that we can continually reduce our environmental footprint at the same time. Whether that's feasible or not, I think there's a reasonable debate to be had. Mm-hmm. And if it doesn't seem to be feasible, then putting limits certainly is a reasonable course.
I
think one of the things we could look at, and Bill and I are in a working group that's talked about this, is limiting what resources you use in new builds. Bill and I are proponents of getting rid of gas in all new builds, because gas is going to produce carbon. Carbon greenhouse gases. So if you cut off the gas meter and just make people use electricity, you know, there's some really high efficient means of heating like heat pumps, then people have to build to the new technology that way, and they're going to use less energy to begin with. So I think if you there's solutions there that are both carrots and sticks out there.
All right, and done by our last 30 seconds, Stephen followed up, said someone, and I think it was Scott, just said that they could assist me in choosing what work is best. Who are they and how do I reach them specifically?
Yeah, just give me a call. I'll give you my number, 585-442-2030, extension 204. That's my office number. And we're happy to help you out.
And just a reminder that on December 12th, Pathstone and Sun Common are hosting an energy efficiency workshop from 5:30 to 6:30 p.m. So December 12th is what day of the week?
It's Tuesday.
You're asking me?
I'm creating the mental image in my head of the calendar.
I think it's a Tuesday.
It's a Tuesday.
December 12th, 5:30 to 6:30 p.m. That's at 404 East Avenue. It's free. Pathstone and Sun Common will answer your questions. It's about energy efficiency at home and just help you understand everything out there, from subsidies to kind of how to do that kind of analysis. So that's a great place to get more questions answered. I want to thank all of our guests, Scott Oliver, Bill Labine, Mike Vigiani, and Professor Eric Hittinger. Thank you to all of you for being here and answering our listeners' questions.
Thank you.
Professor Hittinger, thanks for pushing this conversation forward here. I appreciate that very much.
Oh, always. No
problem. All right. Short break, much more connections coming up.